to say about discussion sections and other technical matters of that sort. But let's jump right into our topic for the morning, religion and culture, the nature of religion. As I was walking over from the office, I was mentioning to Jim Tantillo, one of our TAs, that I sometimes wish that I were teaching chemistry rather than religion, and Jim kindly reminded me that just to remember that after all, it's all biochemistry anyway. And to some extent, this course will be an attempt to suggest that maybe it isn't all just biochemistry, that there may be such realities as human freedom, as moral responsibility, as integrity, character, perhaps even that word that we don't like to use very much today. It was the common parlance of the ancient philosophers, the term virtue. And to a considerable extent, the course is going to address those kinds of questions about who we are and what that means in terms of our relation to our natural environment, how we feel about it, how we think about it, how we treat it. And thus it seems appropriate to start with the observation that we human beings are very strange creatures indeed. We not only live our lives, as is true of every animal and in a certain sense every plant, every living being lives out its lifespan, but as human beings we continually ask the question, how ought we to live them? And the evidence that we've been asking this kind of question for a very long time is pretty solid. We can go back to some of the early cave paintings in southern France. We can see various artifacts that seem to have to do with religion and so on. And it seems as if human beings have not just been living, but have been asking the question for a very long time, how ought we to live? Now, it's possible, of course, that some other animals ask such questions of themselves, but the evidence that they do is not very strong. In fact, I would suggest it's almost non-existent. We don't really have any evidence to suggest that animals ask the question, how ought we to live? It's not to say, of course, that animals don't think. They think a great deal, and in some ways, they are aware of their immediate surroundings, their environment, in far more sophisticated ways than you and I are. We know of some of the special abilities that bats and certain deep sea fish and other animals have, and we can easily point to the fact that cheetahs can run faster than we can, and certain animals can climb quicker and better and so on. So there's no question about the fact that animals think and in some ways are acutely aware of their surroundings, but there is virtually no evidence, I think, that they ask in a philosophical way the question, how ought we to live? That is, they do not appear to ask religious, philosophical, and moral questions in the way that human beings do. Now, some would say, and some mornings I think perhaps they're almost right, that that's a great advantage, because at times we torture ourselves with questions of meaning. I don't know if that happens as much today. When I was your age, a student, existentialism was quite popular as a philosophy, and Camus and Sartre and Heidegger and others were the ones to read and read their novels and so on. And we seemed to spend quite a bit of time torturing ourselves with what it was all about. And there was a lot of angst and anxiety and so on. And so asking the question, how ought we to live, isn't always an advantage. Sometimes it makes our lives less happy, perhaps, at least in the short run, and we wonder whether it's worth all the effort. The problem, however, is that we don't seem to have much choice about it. It seems to be an inevitable part of what it means to be a human being to ask the question, who are we? What's it all mean? What's it all about? How should I live? I think of a short little poem called The Grook by the Danish poet P.H. Hein, translated rather poorly, but still makes the point. He says, I'd like to know what this whole show is all about before it's out. And that's about the way we all are as human beings. At different levels, we all, sooner or later, ask the question, who am I? How should I live? What does it all mean? And thus we have a course like this that starts with the assumption that our environmental problems will demand the best in science and technology if we're to solve them adequately. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not a primitivist. I believe that we need the best science and technology, even though at times I, with some of you, realize the dangers involved. I'm nervous about biotechnology, particularly if people begin to talk about redesigning human beings. But we will need the best that science and technology have to offer, and yet the course assumes that how we treat nature is also, at a very fundamental level, a question of how we understand ourselves. Who are we? How do we live? And what impact does that have on the world about us? Why is it that we are so manipulative, so obsessed with control, so passionate to dominate, so in need of establishing our own worth through our relations to one another and to the world about us? And thus we will address questions of justice and questions of self-image and how that impacts on our relation to nature. But I want to underline that again, that the fact that I shall at times call into question our one-sided obsessive commitment to control and manipulation and perhaps even technology does not mean that I think we can get along without science and technology. One of the books we'll read towards the end of the semester, entitled Green Delusions, is written by Martin Lewis, who believed at one time that we needed to return to a much simpler life without the kind of science and technology we have. And he gradually abandoned that belief because he came to understand that it would make environmental problems worse overall rather than better. It's a controversial book, and we will have some fun discussing it. So what is religion all about? We'll talk later about philosophy and about morality. Of the three, religion is perhaps the hardest to define. If you take the terms in the classic curriculum of a century ago and earlier, God, man, and nature, God, human beings, and nature, they are all incredibly difficult terms. They're terms we use all the time. But as soon as we ask questions like, are human beings fully a part of nature? And many of us would rather quickly answer, of course we are. But then ask the second question, if that's true, then how can we act unnaturally? We immediately begin to sense the difficulty of these fundamental terms. And the term religion, as we shall see, is related closely to those three and is incredibly difficult to get hold of. One of the values, I believe, of trying to unpack the term is that it is one of the terms right at the center of much controversy in America today, over education and over issues like euthanasia and abortion and how we treat animals and other very difficult, wrenching, controversial issues. Perhaps we could get a clue to the nature of religion through a comment that Albert Einstein made not once but repeatedly throughout his life. And I see here almost a kind of contrast between some of the attitudes. I can't remember now whether it was Crick or Watson who had an attitude that seemed to me almost the polar opposite, people who discovered DNA. Einstein used to say repeatedly of his major breakthroughs, "It was given to me. It was given to me." Poets often say, "It came to me." Poets refer to the muse, to spirit, to the experience of something appearing, suddenly appearing with a certain clarity. And it would seem to me that that experience, "It was given to me," that there is something going on in life that seems to go beyond our focused, discursive, analytical attempts at objectivity and understanding, is one facet of what religion has to deal with, and we will explore that in some length in the following weeks. Now, of course, it's always possible, and this will be true throughout the entire course, to look at the same data, the same experiences, in a different way. It's always possible to take a purely reductionist view, to accept Jim's comment that it's all a matter of biochemistry in the last analysis. And Einstein could have also believed that. And there's a tension here, because it is tempting at times, sometimes very tempting, to believe that we have no freedom. Some of you may have studied with Professor Will Provine, who takes that position and defends it very powerfully. It's possible to believe that we are just biochemistry, and that talk of moral responsibility and human freedom and God and religion just doesn't really make sense in the long run. And I don't think there's any obvious simple answer. There's no knockout argument that once and for all will settle that issue. I have tremendous admiration for Professor Provine because he is so open to other ideas and so eminently fair and concerned to hear other people out. And yet I disagree with him that the evidence for a totally materialistic world in which freedom is pure illusion, in which we are essentially robots, I disagree with him, as I'm sure many of you do, that the evidence for that is overwhelming. It's substantial, and at times I'm tempted to think it's overwhelming, as maybe some of you are, but it seems to me these are precisely the issues that are not closed, and part of what it means to be a human being is to raise these issues. I think of a couplet from a couple lines from a poem, or actually a speech, and I could not track down the author. The lines, "Dust we may be, but the dust of a star, and troubled by dreams." And somehow that captures just a little bit of that sense of contradiction, of tension, of puzzlement. We seem to be just like everything else, but it's the dust of a star, and we are troubled by dreams. And it's not accidental that in much of antiquity, and even today to some extent, dreams have been associated closely with religion. Sometimes for very powerful dreams, people use the term vision. And there's been a kind of very close association. I can only think of a few times in my own life when I have had what I would call powerful dreams, but they're very unnerving. sometimes when you have them. I think of one that I had perhaps 30 years ago in Richmond, Indiana, a small town in eastern Indiana where Earlham College is and where I taught for about a dozen years, population of perhaps 40,000, seldom any traffic jams. But I had a dream one night that I was driving along a residential street with the cars parked on both sides of the street, and suddenly from out between two parked cars a little girl, maybe 5 or 6 years old, darted out, and I hit her with a car. And there was that sense of shock, that sense of unreality. And I got out of the car immediately and went around to the front of the car, and there was no one there. Now, that's what Jung and others have referred to as an open-ended dream. But what was even more interesting to me than the open-ended part of the dream was that as soon as I woke up, and I woke up almost instantly, I think, after the dream, although you never know when you're sleeping, my sense was that I woke up right on the spot. I had a very powerful, unambiguous inner sense that I ought to drive more slowly and more carefully when there were parked cars around. And I took that seriously because I seldom have dreams that are what I call powerful dreams. I've only had a few in my whole life. And I drove more slowly. Instead of driving maybe 30 miles an hour, 25 or 30 around parked cars, I slowed down to about 15, which was a bit tedious, frankly, because this is not a big city, and the streets were fairly wide and so on. And I had a sense, a very powerful sense, that I ought to continue this. About 10 days after the dream, I was driving down the street, cars parked on both sides, and from the left side of the street, same as in the dream, a little girl darted out, right in front of the car. I jammed on the brakes and just came short of hitting. And after that experience, the sense that I should drive 15 miles an hour left, just as clearly as that, and that's the end of the dream and the story. Now, I don't know what to make out of that kind of experience. That kind of experience is far more troubling, or far more common, I should say, than we sometimes want to think, although I'm well aware that we have many dreams that are very wild and strange and never come true in any remote sense. What it means that some dreams impress themselves on us more strongly like this, I'm not sure. Let me tell you another dream, another dream that I would call a powerful dream of a different sort, because this illustrates perhaps another dimension of what we sometimes think of as religion. This was a dream also about 30 years ago when I was in Richmond, Indiana, maybe back around 1962. And I'd gotten to know a Jewish student very well during that school year. We had become good friends. My wife and I entertained him at times in our home. And he called me one day and said, let's go see a particular film. And it was a film, and I don't even remember the name anymore, a documentary film on Hitler and the Nazis and the concentration camps, detailed in awful particularity, the experiences of the 10 to 12 million Jews and gypsies and homosexuals and dissident Christians and Europeans. There are about an equal number of Jews and the other categories, maybe 5 or 6 million also. And it was an enormously depressing film. I don't know why it weighed me down as much as it did. Understandably, it would weigh you down some, but it just seemed to totally depress me. And I had this incredibly powerful experience that I would never again be able to laugh or be happy or enjoy life? How could one live with any contentment at all in a world where 6 million Jews and another 5 or 6 million non-Jews were put together, put to death in these concentration camps? What kind of a world was that? Where was God? I just could not see myself laughing and enjoying life again. And for 2 or 3 hours after the film, this student and I just sat together. I think we were in a little cafe locally. I don't know if we were drinking beer or coffee or what, but just sat together, and we said very, very little. For 3 hours, there was an intense sense of communication, of sharing in this experience. And then we both went home. And that night I had a dream that obviously has to be understood in terms of the Jewish scriptures or the Christian Old Testament, because in the dream, like Jacob of old, I was wrestling with another person, a man, and it gradually became clear to me that this was an angel of God, or God himself, or some manifestation of God. And we wrestled and wrestled, and it seemed like this went on forever, just as in the story of Jacob. And finally, as in the biblical story, the angel pinned me, and I had this sense of desperation, and then a sense of letting go, and an incredible sense of resolution, because even though there were no words, and dreams are sometimes like this, it came to me just utterly clearly that what the angel was saying to me was, why are you so proud? Why do you think that the burden of the whole world is yours to bear, and that you can never be happy again? Don't you think God cares about the suffering in his world? And I, because I come out of a Christian background rather than a Jewish background, interpreted this, I think, in the dream understandably, in specifically Christian terms. The angel went on, don't you know that Jesus died for the world, and it's not up to you to do that again? And I awoke. And there was an enormous sense of relief, and I realized that I could laugh and be happy again, because as tragic, as awful as these experiences were, I believed at a more fundamental level that this is God's world, and ultimately things make sense. Now, mind you, I'm not saying that everyone comes to that conclusion. I have great respect for those who have witnessed the Holocaust and haven't been able to resolve it in that way. That the experience has remained an awful, nightmarish type of experience, and that particular kind of resolution has not come, although there have been other resolutions of different sorts. If you read Viktor Frankl or Elie Wiesel or others, you get a sense of how different ones have grappled with those experiences. Now, I share these stories at some length because I think they give us clues to what's going on in this strange arena of human existence that we call religion. And it's why later I'm going to argue that it makes sense, as Tillich and others have done, to interpret the term religion broadly, because I think it's intrinsic. It's an inevitable part. It's of what it means to be a human being that we at times wrestle with those kinds of issues. And what comes out of that wrestling and so on is part of what we mean when we talk about religion. I think religion grows out of the common human experience of contradiction in our lives. That virtually all of us know that there are times when we have acted unjustly. We have treated another human being badly. We have dissimulated, we have lied, we have gossiped, we have done things in our lives of which we are not proud. This close connection between morality and religion is a particular hallmark of Judaism and Christianity and Islam. The connection is not as close in some Eastern religions where we have a more highly developed sense of mysticism and of the wonder and mystery of who God is. Religions coming from Judaism have had this perennial preoccupation and concern for human justice. But I think there's a certain sense in which all religion entails a kind of awareness of contradiction in our lives, that we aren't exactly the way we would like to be. And in a certain sense, no, we ought to be. I think of a very powerful lecture I heard 40-some years ago. Let's see, not quite. 53, I guess, 41 years ago. It's hard to realize one is that old. As a graduate student in Germany, I went to Germany to study philosophy, and the strange set of circumstances was such that I ended up studying mainly religion, because the professor, Dr. Helmut Thielicke, who lectured in this particular lecture hall the hour before the philosophy class, one of them that I was attending, was so interesting. I would sometimes get there early and stand out in the hall and listen to what he was saying, that I got so fascinated that I began to come a whole hour early and sit in the back of the class, and eventually shifted mainly towards working with him. One of the most powerful classes I ever took was a graduate seminar he taught on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German Christian who was active in the resistance movement against Hitler. And Helmut Thielicke gave a lecture that to this day is so clear in my mind, it's as if he spoke the words yesterday. It was entitled Die Theologische Bedeutung des Balletts, the theological significance or meaning of the ballet. He announced the topic, and there was a certain stir in the class. What in the world could he have to say of interest about this? And his argument, in a nutshell, was something like this. He said, in the ballet, as in much dancing, there is a very powerful drive towards creating what in actuality is a kind of illusion, but always more than an illusion. The ballet dancer tries to dance in such a way that she or he gives a sense of effortlessness. There's no such thing as gravity. The floor isn't what holds you up. It's just a kind of reference point towards which you make an occasional gesture. There's a floating, airy, free quality about the ballet. But of course, as Thielicke noted, we all know that that is an illusion of sorts, and that one only learns to be a great ballet dancer through many years of hard, grinding effort, tremendous discipline, exercises that never seem to end. And yet, Thielicke went on to say that just once in a while, among some of the really great dancers, a kind of miracle happens, a kind of metamorphosis, that just once in a while, and the dancer can feel it, and the audience can feel it, and you see it more often in the really great dancers, it really begins to look as if that's the way it is. That we are free, and that gravity doesn't really hold us down, and that we do this spontaneously, and there's a joy in living, and in movement, and a beauty. It does happen occasionally that it almost becomes literally true. And then the reality of fatigue and so on set in again. Tilika said there are two words that he wanted to apply to the ballet. The German word sein, S-E-I-N, which means being, and the German word sollen, S-O-L-L-E-N, which means oughtness. And he said the reason the ballet is a kind of parable for human existence is that we too have dreams of a just world. We have dreams of a world where we would not live by killing, where we would be gentle towards nature, where we would treat one another with dignity and respect. There is this dream, the sense of oughtness of what the world should really be like, but then there's the reality, the sein, the being of who we are. And he said it's precisely that contradiction between being and oughtness that is very much at the heart of a good deal of religion. Taoism, Buddhism, for instance, suggests that if you get in touch with the Tao and learn to flow with the stream of things, don't fight it so much, let it happen and unfold, that contradiction will, at least in part, be overcome. Jews saw it in relation to Torah observance and the cultic life of the community and in living justly with one another before their God. Christians saw it in terms of the fellowship and life of the early community and the meaning of the life of Christ and so on. And just as in the ballet, it happens that once in a while there's a kind of breakthrough and it all seems to be so natural and free and spontaneous. Tilika said that once in a while we are graced with that incredible experience that we really seem to live justly and live with respect towards others and a kind of generosity and magnanimity without effort. Doesn't always last very long, and we're aware that there are those models, those people like Mother Teresa and others who have progressed further, but that there is that glimpse of something more than what we usually are. And indeed, Tilika said, it's precisely there that the eschatological hope, the hope for the future, the hope of the life to come, plays itself out, that it is precisely the belief of many Christians, for instance, and others, that in the life to come we will become fully what we are meant to be. And the contradiction between being and oughtness, between sein and sollen, will be a thing of the past. I'm not giving you a definition of religion. I'll perhaps attempt that later. I'm trying to get you to think a little bit about it at this point. Just one last comment, and then I want to take the last 10 minutes for setting up the discussion sections and so on, introducing the TAs. One of the contradictions or problems in the academic study of religion is that we can always view these kinds of experiences in reductionist terms. We can take Jim's biochemistry approach. We can always suggest and believe with some plausibility that the dreams are just coincidence, the experience of forgiveness and grace and the goodness of life are simply that we've had the right vitamins and enough exercise. We can take the comparative religion approach to the study of religion, what the Germans call the religionsgeschichtliche Methode, the religious history, historical method, and in a sense make God himself and certainly religion and religious experience an object of our control and our intensive study. And to some extent this course will use a religionsgeschichtliche method, a comparative religion method, because that does give us certain kinds of insights into religion and religious experiences. From this perspective, religion is the quest of human beings to make sense out of the contradictions in their own existence, the puzzlements, the sense of the mysterious and the lack of clarity about who they are and how they ought to live. But I think if one is faithful to the material itself and to the experience of religious people, again, whether Hindus or Buddhists or Jews or Muslims, whatever, Christians, that one would also have to say that the other possibility is that religion is essentially the fallout of what happens when God or the Tao or some fundamental reality seeks us and addresses us and holds us accountable. And it seems to me in one sense that the modern university is afraid of that latter possibility. And the modern university in some ways is like a institution that says to its chemistry professors or its physics professors, you may only study what past chemists and physicists have done. You may not do any experiments yourself. And many religion professors try to be very objective and cool and maintain a certain distance from the subject matter and would never want to be associated with any charismatic Pentecostals or other people who do strange things. I'm being ironic, I hope you realize, sarcastic. And I'm going to try to steer a middle course. That is, I'm going to try to be faithful to the texts and the materials in a scholarly sense, but also recognize that it doesn't quite make sense to talk about religion in the way we would want a chemist to talk about chemistry and say you never could do any experiments in chemistry. I don't know exactly what that means about how the course goes, and I have to sort of find that out as we go along, and it always seems to be a little different. But I wanted to mention that because in some ways that's a little bit scary. In some ways, talking about religion and culture and the impact on the environment and lifestyle and consumption and treatment of animals and so on, where you think that it might really make a difference in how we live, is a little bit scary. And we tend to shy away from that. And finally, it's also something that we're hesitant about doing, and I'll close with this final observation. Because in some ways, our attitude towards religion in the modern Western university is analogous to the alleged attitude of Victorians towards sexuality. I say alleged because there's now a fair amount of evidence that the Victorians weren't as Victorian as they were held to be. There was more going on that we knew about. That is, Victorians, strangely enough, could talk rather easily about the sexuality of South Sea Islanders or African natives. I can remember even as a child, and this was long after the Victorian period, the National Geographic would show bare-breasted African women and naked men from Borneo or someplace, but they wouldn't have dared do that with European men or women or Americans. And in some ways, but the Victorians were very hesitant about talking about their own sexuality. They were very private and considered that almost obscene. I think, oddly enough, that's a little bit like we are in the modern university when it comes to religion. It's relatively easy for a professor at Cornell to talk about Native American religions, not much embarrassment, not a sense of imposing one's values on others. One can even talk fairly easily about Buddhism, maybe Confucianism or Taoism. It gets a little tougher when you talk about Islam or Judaism, quite a bit tougher if you talk about Catholicism or mainstream liberal Protestantism. But if you talk about, let's say, evangelical or, God forbid, fundamentalist American religion as if you really believe some of it, all hell breaks loose socially. People somehow get nervous You're not supposed to do that. And that's very, very interesting to me, because it seems to be a way of disenfranchising or marginalizing certain views about reality with which one disagrees. We'll talk more about this later. I want to try to steer a middle course between an imposition of views and a lack of tolerance for diversity, and on the other hand, this strange sort of self-censorship that one can't really talk easily about the significance of the beliefs and so on of a very large number of our fellow Americans. And thus this course will deal fairly openly, fairly candidly, not only with philosophical materials and some literary materials and ethical materials, but also some religious materials. Okay, let's very quickly get to the section. Would you hand out, did you all get those little 3x5 cards? You should have a little 3x5 card. And I want you to, came out here. I want you to fill those out. Something like I have here, name, class, major, and local phone. Now, what we want to do is to put as many of you as possible into a section of your first choice. And some years we're very successful in this. Virtually everyone gets in first or second choice, and maybe 70% of you in the first choice. But in order for this to work, you have to be fairly honest. We have to really work this out with a kind of responsibility towards each other. Let me just get a show of hands, because we might be able to eliminate one or two of these right away. If we knocked out the Friday section at 8 o'clock, how many of you could still... How many of you would not be able to make one of the other sections if we knocked out the Friday at 8? Wonderful, wonderful. Let's knock out we're making progress. Okay, now, how many of you, Jim, I forget how we do this. I think those others we can all leave in. Let me just get a sense of, because I'd like to leave all the others in. I think it gives us more diversity. We'll probably have multiple sections, say, at 10:10. But just to get a very quick sense, of where you all are, how many of you would prefer to a Thursday at 10:10? Just without committing yourself, just a quick show of hands. Okay, how many of you would prefer Thursday at 11:15? Okay, at 12:20 and 1:25. Okay, those are, and how many of you would prefer Friday at 9:05 and Friday at 10:10? Okay, I think we're in great shape. Fill out the cards with the information there, and then put as many of the sections as you can make in order of preference. Number one would be your first preference, number two your second. I think this is going to be relatively easy just from that rough show of hands. I'm not sure where the registration will settle out. The course is still open, but I think that looks very good. Let me then take just the last couple of minutes to introduce the two TAs and have them say a couple words about themselves. Jim Tantillo, would you stand? Jim is something of an institution here at Cornell. He has, without exaggeration, been one of the finest TAs I've ever worked with. I worked with him a number of years, even before he was a graduate student. I just hired him as an individual to work with a course. And he truly has been one of the best TAs I've ever worked with. He has a great love of ideas, a disciplined mind. He takes his students very seriously, spends a lot of time working with them. And Jim, I'm very, very pleased that you'll be working with the course again this spring. Jim is a graduate of our own Department of Natural Resources, although he did his first couple of years in the College of William and Mary. He has strong interests in history and philosophy, as well as natural resources. And Jim, would you say just a word about your thesis research? Okay, Carl Johnson, would you stand so people can recognize you? This is Carl's first year working as a TA. He's a starting graduate student in the field of natural resources. He's worked for a number of years at Cornell in outdoor education programming and for the Ithaca Youth Bureau, the City of Ithaca Youth Bureau. He graduated from Cornell in 1989. Carl, we're very pleased to have you also as a TA. Would you say, too, please, just a word or two about what you think your thesis research will be?